In the Obama White House, we love to use our Twitter accounts to break news. By going around the media, we could give the public the feeling that they had as much right to the information as the professional reporters who cover the White House. Twitter democratized the distribution of information. We never fully committed to this strategy because we tried to find a balance between using this new tool and managing our relationship with the White House press corps, which did not appreciate losing their role as the middleman. Trump took this to the next level in both the campaign and the White House. If you want to know what Trump is doing or saying, all you have to do is follow his Twitter account. Even though it's a little, okay, a lot, like a car crash, America can't turn away from Trump's Twitter. Caution to the wind. Pre-Twitter politics rewarded risk aversion. Twitter rewards risk-taking because it rewards authenticity and interestingness. There is an inherent risk in being yourself in politics, which is why so many politicians speak in platitudes and avoid taking positions for fear of pissing off the wrong people. I'm not sure this was ever a good political strategy, but it certainly isn't a good strategy on Twitter, which can have a vicious mob mentality reaction to inauthenticity. Putting down one's guard, particularly in a hypercritical place like Twitter, can be profoundly uncomfortable for a politician. But there is no option. Twitter is the medium and language of politics. Important note, you don't have to be an asshole, but you do have to be interesting. Too often people on Twitter, including you-know-who, confuse the two. Twitter has also changed political journalism in ways that enable Trump and his ilk to game the system. And the media needs to adopt new rules to protect their important role in the process. Report first, analyze later. Back in the old days of newspapers, there were three types of people who wrote about politics. Reporters, who told the story of what happened. This is classic, objective, just-the-facts, ma'am, Joe Friday-style reporting. Columnists, who offered up clearly demarcated opinions. Think George Will, Maureen Dowd, and Charles Blow. The newspapers thought it was so important that these pieces not be confused with the reporting function of the paper that they put these columns on an entirely separate page. Analysts, the most senior reporters with the most experience, who were periodically given the opportunity to write a piece analyzing why something happened or was likely to happen. This privilege was earned from decades of experience and granted to the smartest reporters, and this work was clearly labeled analysis because it fell somewhere between objective reporting and subjective columns. Twitter changed all that because it was for a long time a failed state, ungoverned by the normal rules of journalism, and ignored by the powers that be at the papers. Reporters opined, and even the most junior reporter was free to offer their political analysis of the most complex situations. Sometimes this analysis crossed the line into opining. The downside of this approach is that it erodes the authority of fact-based reporting and makes journalists no different from the talking heads that populate cable TV networks. When the lines between facts and opinion blur, it provides an opening for those who view facts as obstacles and not pillars to an argument. Just in case I was too subtle, yes, I am talking about Donald J. Trump and his MAGA minions. Don't fuck up. In 2013, I was slated to do all five Sunday shows to respond to allegations about political interference at the IRS. This was my first grilling on the Sunday shows, and it was going to be a high-wire act. I emailed David Plouffe to get some advice on how to handle this challenge. His response? Don't fuck up. I would offer the same helpful advice to the media. Twitter makes it easier to get information to the public. This faster, easier process also means more mistakes, bad reporting, misunderstood information, and less context. Errors are not new in journalism. There is the famous case of 60 Minutes using forged documents about George W. Bush's military service. There is the New York Times scrutiny-free regurgitation of cherry-picked intelligence about WMD in Iraq. And there are garden-variety mistakes that come from the fact that journalism is a human enterprise. But Twitter has removed all the checks and balances of the editorial process. All the reporter has to do is type out 280 characters of info and hit tweet. Less oversight means more mistakes, and the media has been slow to recognize that a mistake on Twitter ends up being much more consequential than one made in the paper or on the air. The Twitter error circulates via retweets long after it is ever fixed. These errors provide a cudgel for the right to discredit accurate reporting about the flaws in their policies and the foibles of their president. Now everyone makes mistakes. But media outlets need to treat mistakes on their Twitter feed the way they would treat those errors if they appeared in the paper or were broadcast on the air. Fix them fast and be transparent about how they happened. Twitter, the platform, has a lot of work to do to protect itself and the public from the worst elements of our society. Stop the bullying and ban the trolls. Twitter, the company, has utterly failed to police their own platform. Scroll through the mentions of a woman or a person of color on Twitter and you are bound to be horrified by what you read. There was racism, misogyny, and threats of violence and sexual assault. This problem existed long before Trump, but his rise enabled and empowered far-right hate accounts to be more public. Twitter has even verified some of these hate mongers, giving them the vaunted blue checkmark. Twitter has been impossibly slow to act, in part because kicking a bunch of people off the platform would exacerbate the problem of anemic user growth. but it is a solvable problem. Enforce their policies against hate speech and bullying with a consistent zero-tolerance policy. End the anonymity granted to users. There is no valid reason to let people spew hate anonymously. Much of the hate, abuse, and trolling would immediately disappear if people had to do it for the world to see using their real names. Ban hate groups identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center. I am sympathetic to Twitter's views about the First Amendment, but the Constitution doesn't grant people the right to use Twitter for their speech. Stop the bots. With the help of Russia, thousands of automated accounts shifted the conversation on Twitter in ways favorable to Trump. This is probably the easiest problem to solve. Twitter just has to want to do it. Twitter seems terrible. It reminds us of everything we have come to hate about politics in the Trump era. I never feel better after I open the app. I also can't stop myself from opening it. Twitter may have gotten us into this mess, but it may also be the way out of it. On the first weekend Trump was president, Americans swarmed airports across the country to protest the patently racist Muslim travel ban that Trump had announced late the night before. Hallie and I went to the San Francisco airport. Like so many others, we were offended and alarmed by Trump's action. It was the exact opposite of the ideals we had worked so hard for in the previous administration. But we also wanted to be with people who shared our outrage and fear about the direction the country was rapidly headed. Sitting on the couch and scrolling through Twitter in anger, often my natural state, felt like a mistake. I expected there would be a handful of people, maybe 100, which would be impressive for a protest on a Saturday against a not-yet-implemented executive order. When our Lyft arrived to pick us up, the driver saw that we were headed to the airport with no bags. "Are you guys going to the protest? I'm going to head there later this afternoon," he said. "What are the odds of that?" I thought to myself. When we pulled up to the airport, we could hear the chanting. Inside were well over 1,000 people from all walks of life. Older former hippies who'd probably come to San Francisco during the Summer of Love and never left. Tattooed hipsters, tech types in their hoodies and Facebook t-shirts, and millennials alternately protesting and documenting the proceedings on their phones. The whole scene was incredibly emotional, like the Women's March of the week before. This was not a protest of anger. There was no cursing, vandalism, or threats. Just pure civil disobedience. People were happy to be a part of something bigger than themselves. I was struck by how this many people could end up here so quickly. How did they know about the Muslim ban? It was a Saturday during the NFL playoffs, not exactly a time when people are glued to cable TV. It was also clear that there was no group organizing the protests, which is frankly how most protests happen these days. Yet somehow, all these people from all these different walks of life had gathered together at a moment's notice, a flash mob for equality and decency. I heard a group of people standing near Hallie and me talking to one another. "How'd you hear about all this?" "I saw it on Twitter, and it felt like somewhere I should be, so I came." Twitter. It's not all bad. Chapter 9. From 1600 Penn to Keep It at 1600. Not long after I returned from my hospital stay, the president called me down to the Oval Office. The ostensible purpose of this visit was for the president to check in with me on the news of the day and get a sense of how the government shutdown was playing out in the press. Or so I thought. "How you feeling?" Obama asked me. "Not bad. The press seems to be in a good place. They get who's at fault here and think the Republicans have completely fumbled the ball." "No. How are you doing? What are the doctors saying?" Obama pushed. Caught off guard, I stammered. I feel better. I'm tired, but what else is new?" "The doctors don't have a great answer, but they believe I have a blood vessel in my brain that spasms when my blood pressure gets too high." As I said these words out loud, I realized how scary this sounded, and that I might have been so focused on returning to work that I hadn't thought through how dire my situation was. "Blood vessel in the brain sounds kind of serious," Obama said with some understatement. "I mean, yeah, but I'm now on medication which will deal with the blood pressure issue. It will be fine," I protested a little too much. "You have been with me for a long time, from the very beginning of this journey. You have given as much to this endeavor as anyone. If you need to leave to get your health in order, I want you to do that. My first choice, of course, is for you to stay, but I want you to put your health first." "I hear you. Dr. Jackson says with medication changes and some lifestyle adjustments, there is no reason I can't do my job," I responded, referring to the president's personal physician who had been monitoring my treatment. "Look, I'm not old enough to be your father, but I could be your older brother." This was how Obama started all of his very valuable life advice to me, just to make it clear that he was only 14 years older than me. "This is important work, probably the most important work we will ever do, but it's not everything. You have to think about the rest of your life, too." I didn't decide to leave the White House right there in the Oval Office, but it was where the seed was planted. It was the first time I thought about how much life there was outside the 18 acres of the White House and how little of it I was experiencing. I wasn't ready to leave yet, but for the first time I let the thought enter my mind. A lot of my White House colleagues used to joke that I was going to be the one to turn out the lights at the White House. I always responded that I would leave the White House like Matt Damon at the end of Good Will Hunting. One day, everyone would show up to the morning senior staff meeting in the chief of staff's office, and I just wouldn't be there. But I knew deep down that my colleagues were probably right. I loved my job. I loved walking into that building every day. Every time I boarded Air Force One or landed on the South Lawn late at night on Marine One was the thrill of a lifetime. It never got old. But the White House was my entire life. I had put everything else on hold for nearly a decade now. Barack Obama came first, second, and third. I had missed countless family trips, weddings, reunions, and just being there when my friends and family needed me. Senior White House aides work in 2-year increments. Come, stay till the next election. And if you stay after that, you're signing up to stay till the next election. In my mind, I circled the 2014 midterm elections on the calendar. This was the last exit on the highway. I either left around then or agreed to stay till the end. Obama had always talked about the presidency as a relay race. There comes a time to pass the baton to the next person. As the calendar counted down to decision time, it was becoming increasingly clear to me what the right decision was. After 6 years in the White House and 2 on the campaign, I was physically and emotionally exhausted. The normal wear and tear was worsened by the emotional stress of my health issues. I couldn't sleep for months afterwards, in large part because when you check out of the stroke unit of a hospital, they tell you that if you feel the symptoms, come to the hospital immediately, because there is a life-saving treatment they can give you if it is within a few hours of the onset of the stroke. But, and this is a big but, they say that if the stroke happens while you are sleeping, there is no way to know when it started, so no medication for you. How could anyone sleep well after that? I woke up dozens of times a night for months, afraid I was having a stroke. Yet ironically, one of the things that can prevent strokes is getting sleep. I was burning out quickly. The extraordinary was starting to feel more ordinary. The abnormal of the Republican reaction to Obama was starting to feel a little too normal for comfort. The other argument for leaving was Halley. I will note that when editing this book, Halley commented, "Great point," about this sentence. A lot of relationships blossomed among White House staffers because only another White House staffer understood the pressures and commitments of the job. Halley understood when I had to mysteriously and suddenly cancel a beach weekend with no explanation. I was going with Obama on a secret trip to Afghanistan. When my life blew up because of some work thing, she understood because it usually meant that her life was blowing up too. Our relationship was new, but it was a long time in the making, and it changed everything. When President Obama learned that we were dating, he told me that she had a great spirit, which is the perfect way of describing her infectious energy, kindness, and humor. She's the brightest light in every room she enters. We started working in the same office in late 2011. Before that, she was working on the First Lady's staff. On Halley's first day working in the West Wing, Obama stormed into the office suite where we all sat together and called for Jay Carney and me to come out of our offices. We were in the middle of a big fight with the Republicans over the extension of a tax cut. Even though Republicans had never met a tax cut they didn't like, they were opposing this one because, 1, it had Obama's name on it. 2, it seemed to be helping the economy in the run-up to his re-election campaign. The president stood directly in front of Halley's desk and began a 20-minute, not entirely family-friendly rant about the opposition party. The only thing dividing Halley from the President of the United States was her computer monitor. I was standing on the other side of Halley's desk from Obama. As I engaged in the discussion with Obama, I could see Halley out of the corner of my eye. She seemed totally unfazed by the president. She was sitting with perfect posture and continuing to type away in her keyboard, not allowing Obama to distract her from the work at hand or look to be eavesdropping on the very lively conversation taking place inches from her. Who was this perfectly poised woman who had joined our team? Then I looked at her computer screen. She was just typing gibberish over and over again. I didn't know it at the time, but I had just fallen in love. We became colleagues and then friends, bonding over our shared love of hip-hop and television shows such as Sons of Anarchy and The Wire. Before too long, it was clear we were both interested in more than just a friendship. About 18 months after the typing incident, we went on our first date, in New York City. We were both going to be visiting friends there at the same time. D.C. is a small town, and the White House is even smaller. We had no idea if our chemistry worked outside the office. We wanted to find out without everyone in the White House knowing. It was a long weekend, and Obama was on vacation. We coincidentally ended up on the same train to New York, so we had a drink when we got to the city, sort of a pre-date, if you will. We had dinner on Saturday night, and after dinner, we walked all over the city, with Halley showing me her favorite haunts from when she lived there after college. The next day, she took me to her favorite pizza place before I was supposed to go meet some friends, so she came with me. Then I went to meet her friends. We had another date Sunday night, and then the same thing on Monday. We returned to D.C. on Tuesday and decided to order Thai food and watch a movie. Needless to say, we still had the chemistry. A few weeks after we started dating, I planned our first weekend away together. I invited Howley to come to my family's home on the Outer Banks of North Carolina for Labor Day weekend. This was my favorite place on the planet. It was where I escaped whenever we got a break at the White House, and I wanted to share it with her. We were both pretty excited about the upcoming trip, but like so much in the White House, events intervened. A few days before we were supposed to leave, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons on his citizens, precipitating a potential military conflict with the United States. Vacation canceled. I was going to have to spend the weekend waiting around the White House, working on the announcement of a potential strike against the Syrian regime. Ben Rhodes and his team on the National Security Council were taking the lead, but I certainly couldn't be lounging on a beach with my new girlfriend when it happened, if it happened. Holly, who can find fun in any activity, and as always, I mean always, planning something, proposed a staycation at my apartment, in between trips to the White House for meetings. As an example of her planning prowess, Holly planned a July 4th, 2017 trip to Montreal with our friends in February of 2016. We, mostly Holly, planned every minute of the weekend, the food we were going to eat, the cocktails we were going to make, and the movies we were going to watch. The plan was that Holly and I were going to meet at my apartment on Friday after work and get takeout from somewhere nicer than the usual rotation of Chinese and Thai places. Around 7 p.m. on Friday, Holly texted me to say she was walking out the door. Leaving at 10, meet me at my apartment in 30, I responded. I shut down my computer, packed my bag, and bade farewell to Clay Dumas, my special assistant, who sat outside my office. I was halfway down the hall when Clay called for me. POTUS wants to see you. He's in the Oval. I put my bag and phone on Clay's desk and walked to the hall for what I assumed would be a brief meeting. Obama was rarely still in the office this late because he was religious about getting home for dinner with the family before working late into the night in his study. But as his daughters had gotten older, they were often doing things in the evening, especially on Fridays, and Obama lingered longer before heading to the residence. When I walked into the Oval Office, Obama was standing at his desk. Hey, sorry to blow up your Friday night, but I was just taking a walk with Dennis and I had an idea. I asked the rest of the team to come down so I could run it by you guys. What ensued was a nearly two-hour meeting about seeking congressional approval for a missile strike against Syria. Because no phones are allowed in the Oval Office, and this wasn't the sort of meeting you walked out of to text your date, I was stuck sitting there with no way to tell Holly what had happened. With every passing minute, I got more anxious that I was about to blow it with this woman. The second the meeting ended, I hustled to my desk, grabbed my phone, and sent an apologetic text. I couldn't explain the gravity of the subject matter because it was classified, but it didn't matter. Holly hadn't doubted me or assumed I was blowing her off. She took matters into her own hands, picked a restaurant, ordered food, and was on the way to my apartment. I picked her up mid-walk, and we ate a very late, very cold dinner on the roof deck of my apartment. We talked about everything except work, which was so great. This was a hallmark of our early relationship. We left work at the gates of the White House. The abbreviated staycation weekend was when it became clear that Holly and I were on a path to start a life together. I wanted us to go to the movies without having to leave in the middle to get on a conference call, to go on uninterrupted dinner dates and not have to cancel vacations because of world events. I wanted a life that resembled normalcy, and I wanted it with her. During the holidays in 2014, Holly and I had taken a few days and headed to her native Bay Area. Miraculously, it was a quiet week in White House-adjusted terms. We wandered the streets of San Francisco, we saw friends, we went wine tasting. We lived life in a way that just wasn't possible in our current jobs. This was a joint decision. We were going to leave the White House together and start the next chapter of our lives. I knew this was the right decision, but I was still nervous about it. I had seen friends leave the White House and go into a deep depression as they detoxed from the narcotic adrenaline of working in the most important building in the world. But I was willing to take the risk for a life with Holly. I was ready to pass the baton to the next person. All that was left next was to tell the president. I kept making excuses not to tell him, and Holly started to worry that I was going to change my mind. On the day after the State of the Union, I was traveling with Obama on Air Force One when I went into his cabin to break the news. He was seated at the desk, and I plopped down on the couch. The president knew why I was there. The rumor mill had been churning about my departure for a few weeks. He looked up from the briefing book he was reading and muted the TV, which was showing ESPN. "Do you have some news for me?" he said knowingly. "Yes, sir, I do. Working for you has been the greatest privilege of my life, but the time has come." Obama pointed out that other than him, I was the only one left who had started on the first day of the campaign and served in the White House the whole 6 years. He was more than kind about my decision. "Look, I owe you a lot. I wouldn't be here without you," Obama graciously told me. Even though I knew this wasn't completely true, it meant the world to hear him say it. Right when I was about to get emotional, we both started laughing and reminiscing about the past 8 years, the good times, the bad times, but mostly the funny times. Right before we landed, Obama asked me what I was going to do next. "Honestly, I have no idea," I replied on my way out of his cabin. Detox. Halligan and I came up with a pretty ingenious plan to detox from the White House. Leave the country and don't look back. This is also our Trump gets reelected plan. Within days of turning in our Blackberries and White House badges, we were on a plane for a 6-week journey of eating, drinking, and relaxing across Southeast Asia. We ate Michelin-starred dim sum in a mall food court in Hong Kong. We rode elephants in the jungles of northern Thailand. We went to Muay Thai boxing matches with the locals. We cruised down the Mekong in Laos drinking homemade whiskey fermenting with snakes and scorpions. We toured the ruins of Angkor Wat in Cambodia. We lounged on the beach reading books and sipping cocktails on an island off the coast of Vietnam. We ate pho and drank homemade beer in the old town of Hanoi. It was amazing. I never missed or even really thought about what was happening in the White House. We didn't get international cell phone plans. The president had told Hallie we should never take our phones out of the hotel safe, so our only access to the internet was in the morning and evening at the hotel. When hotel staff or airline attendants would offer us English language newspapers, we would reject them the way Trump would reject a salad not served in a taco bowl. Ignorance, for once, was bliss. When we returned to the United States, I started to do some paid speeches and was serving as a fellow at the Institute of Politics that David Axelrod started at his alma mater in Chicago. I was writing some freelance pieces for Grantland, the now defunct ESPN-owned sports and pop culture website started by Bill Simmons. And of course, I was active on Twitter with my new civilian account. I was adjusting much better to life on the outside than I had imagined. Whenever I thought about leaving the White House, I remembered a Washington Post story from 2008 about a trio of Bush aides who had recently left government service. One of those aides was Dan Bartlett, Bush's longtime communications advisor. Bartlett shared an anecdote about going golfing on a weekday. After several hours, he realized he hadn't received a single email. Assuming his phone wasn't working, he called his wife and asked her to send him a test email. It arrived right away. This anecdote always stuck with me about the challenges of going from being in demand 24/7 to being a normal human. Much to my surprise, I love not being in demand. I love being able to go to a restaurant without spending half the meal outside of my phone. And I love sleeping so much. After 5 or so hours of sleep a night for 8 years, every time I woke up after the sun came up felt like an amazing luxury. Another thing I noticed with my speaking and tweeting was how much I loved speaking for myself, saying what was on my mind and not trying to channel what was on Obama's. It felt so liberating. Barack Obama never asked me to say anything I didn't believe. Far from it. I wouldn't have been there if I didn't believe in him and his agenda. But there was a freedom in speaking for myself and not for a president, absent the scrutiny that comes with being an official spokesperson for the entire United States government. With this in mind, I accepted an offer from CNN to be a political commentator for the network. I did this with some trepidation, mainly because I was scarred from the pressure that comes with being trotted out on TV as the tip of the White House's spear. I had appeared on the Sunday shows a handful of times during my tenure as senior advisor. I prepped for these appearances as if they were the bar exam. I would take home a 30-page briefing and read it all Friday night before returning to the office on Saturday for another several hours before going home to study all night. On the morning of the interview, there would be a conference call with the communication staff and the National Security Council to prepare answers for anything that happened overnight. Needless to say, Clay, my hero of an assistant, and the press staff didn't love when I signed up to do the shows. In March 2014, I was on Meet the Press right after Vladimir Putin in Russia had invaded Crimea, which heretofore had been a part of the independent state of Ukraine. I was given a set of very pugnacious talking points by Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, which I appreciated because a lot of the approved talking points for delicate national security situations sounded exactly like what they were, verbal applesauce designed to say nothing and offend no one. A few days later, the Russian government announced that they had sanctioned a number of U.S. government officials, banning them from traveling to Russia. On the list were several U.S. lawmakers, including Democratic and Republican congressional leadership, the White House official responsible for coordinating and implementing U.S. sanctions on Russia, Rhodes, who was one of Obama's closest foreign policy advisors, and me. The role of White House senior advisor comes with many duties, but U.S.-Russia policy is not one of them, so I was more than a little surprised to be included on the list. I had never been to Russia and had no plans to travel there, but it was a weird feeling to know I was personally banned from visiting another country. How the hell did I end up on this list? I asked the National Security aide traveling with us on Air Force One when the list came out. You talk shit about Putin on Meet the Press. I have no idea if this is true, but it made me choose my words on television even more carefully going forward. A few days into my new role as a paid pundit, I was on my way to the CNN studios when I got a news alert on my phone saying that Donald Trump was going to run for president. I knew from Trump's ill-fated birther crusade from a few years earlier that everything else in politics was about to be put on pause. It was going to be all Trump all the time for what I assume would be a brief foray into politics as part of a PR stunt. Like everyone else in Democratic political circles, I saw Trump's entry in the race as a great political gift. A reality TV star running on a racist platform, espousing conspiracy theories that spoke to a large part of the GOP base, would pull the entire field to the right, making the eventual nominee, who of course wouldn't be Trump, entirely unelectable. Well, not everyone. Keeping it 1600. In early 2016, I got a particularly interesting email from Jon Favreau. It was a forward of an email exchange he was having with Bill Simmons, who had just started a new media company, asking if John had any interest in doing a political podcast with me as part of Simmons' new podcast network. I was a huge fan of Simmons, who'd pioneered a new style of internet-friendly writing that mixed sports and pop culture. I would read his columns and mailbag articles when I ate lunch at my desk in the White House. I consumed his 700-page book on basketball in a weekend. Simmons was also very prescient about how the internet was changing the kind of information people wanted and how they wanted to consume it. Back in 2008, he was one of the first people to experiment with a new format called podcasting. Simmons had pitched us on getting Obama on his podcast in 2008, and we were all set to do it before management at ESPN, which hosted the podcast, nixed the event because they didn't want to get involved in politics. In 2012, John and I made another run at getting Obama to appear on Simmons' podcast to talk about sports, pop culture, and politics. Because the campaign was not yet in full swing and Obama was president, not just a candidate, ESPN agreed. The Obama appearance was a huge hit and served as a fairly explicit contrast to Mitt Romney, who was too stiff to engage in such a conversation and used the term sport instead of sports, like everyone else. Romney sounded like he was talking about croquet and dressage instead of basketball and baseball. As an aside, the Romneys actually owned a horse named Rafalka that competed in the 2012 Olympics in dressage, which is the equine equivalent of synchronized swimming. For fun, I made my computer password some version of Rafalka for over a year. As a test, Simmons invited John and me onto his incredibly popular podcast. Through the years, I've been on Meet the Press, The Nightly News, and most every major news program, but being on Simmons' podcast beat them all. I heard from more friends and family about that appearance than any other media I had done in my career, if you don't count the time Jon Stewart ridiculed me for 2 minutes on The Daily Show because of a less than stellar appearance on the Sunday shows. The response was good, so Simmons asked us to tape a test podcast of the two of us just talking about politics. John and I were initially confused about how to do this. We didn't know how to podcast, so we just talked about the news like we normally would. When we'd finished, I'd felt pretty good about it. It had been fun, and thanks to Trump, there had been no shortage of things to talk about. I was glad it was a dry run because I was sure we had a lot of kinks to work out. Except it wasn't. Simmons' staff posted it on the internet, and a few hours later, Keeping It 1600 was born. Well, actually, it started untitled. Our first choice for a title was Politics as Usual, naming it after the Jay-Z song, but that was taken. Then we named it Playing Politics, which was an ironic homage to an Obama-ism that politics isn't a game. After we announced that as a title, we discovered that the Minneapolis Star Tribune editorial board had a podcast by the same name, which made it impossible for listeners to search for it on iTunes. Out of desperation, we asked people on Twitter for suggestions, and one very talented user suggested Keep It at 1600. It made absolutely no sense to anyone, but that's why it was funny. The podcast was essentially the conversation about politics that John and I had been having for years, in person or over text, but now for all the world to hear. We were shocked, to say the least, that people actually listened to it. Our immediate family and former Obama administration colleagues, sure, but people we didn't know, that seemed impossible. Yet for some reason they did. After a few months, we added a second weekly episode and brought on John Lovett, a former Obama speechwriter who'd been the chief architect of all of Obama's White House Correspondents' Dinner speeches, and Tommy Vietor, who'd started out as a junior press aide on Obama's 2004 Senate race and risen all the way up to being the spokesperson for the National Security Council before leaving the White House to start a consulting firm with Favreau. They added new perspectives, Tommy's deep knowledge of foreign policy, and Lovett's sense of humor and unconventional takes. In this hour a week of unfiltered, uncensored discussion with an engaged, enthusiastic audience, I had found the perfect place to observe and analyze the 2016 election. The early days of the podcast were more than a little ragtag. I conducted our first interview with then-Labor Secretary and current DNC Chair Tom Perez on my cell phone from the supply closet of the tech company I worked for at the time. We had to stop the interview whenever someone came in to get a pen or a mouse pad. I had to explain to one potential guest what a podcast was. It's like radio, but on demand. Eventually, people became familiar with what we were doing. I had even gotten an actual microphone, but we didn't get too fancy. I continued to record at my kitchen table, and still do. It was fun as hell, though. Podcasting would, of course, just be a temporary gig until Hillary Clinton's inevitable win in November, and then I would retire from podcasting and politics. Oops. Interlude 3, Advice You Can Believe In. Barack Obama has many opportunities in the post-presidency phase of his life. He will be an author, a speaker, and the leader of a foundation. Maybe he will get to fulfill his dream and own an NBA team, but if none of those things work out for him, I have a suggestion. Advice columnist. My last day at the White House happened to fall on a day when the president was traveling to South Carolina. I decided to go along for one last flight on Air Force One, and being out of the office seemed likely to reduce the number of awkward goodbyes that I wanted to avoid at all costs. There was some symmetry to this visit. It was Obama's first visit to the state since his shockingly large victory in the South Carolina primary propelled him toward the Democratic nomination. The staff had also arranged a surprise meeting for Obama with Edith Childs, the South Carolina City Councilwoman, whom we called the fired up and ready to go lady. Miss Childs was the star of the story about how one voice could change the world, and it ended almost every speech Obama gave on the trail in 08. By the end of the campaign, the entire staff and press corps could recite every word of the story from memory. All in all, it seemed like a fitting last day at the White House. After the last event in South Carolina, I rode in the presidential limo with Obama to the airport for the flight back to D.C. I was telling him about my post-White House trip to Asia and that Hallie and I were debating where to move when we got back. "What's on the list?" Obama asked. "New York and San Francisco," I replied. "Can't go wrong there. Two great but very different cities. New York is a lot, so it's less relaxing. I love San Francisco, but the time change is a real thing." I dismissed the time change argument out of hand. But I would learn years later that Obama was right when I would wake up at the crack of dawn in fear of what war or national embarrassment Trump had caused from his Twitter account while I was sleeping. "So you guys moving together? This is the one, huh?" Obama was always very proud of the hundreds of relationships that had sprung from his campaigns and his administration. As one example, in 2016, I went to four different weddings of people who met working for Barack Obama. One of those was mine. He continued, "Here's the advice I give everyone about marriage. Is she someone you find interesting?" I was initially confused by the question, but I figured he must have a point. "You will spend more time with this person than anyone else for the rest of your life, and there is nothing more important than always wanting to hear what she has to say about things. Does she make you laugh? I don't know if you want kids, but if you do, do you think she will be a good mom? Life is long. These are the things that really matter over the long term." We had just pulled up to the plane, and the world was waiting for us to get out. "Hallie is incredibly interesting, funnier than I am, and will be a phenomenal mom," I told the president. "Sounds like she's the one. Lucky you," Obama told me as he exited the limo and headed up the stairs to go on Air Force One. A year later, Hallie and I were engaged, and this is the advice I now give everyone about relationships. I credit Obama, most of the time. Chapter 10, The 2016 Campaign Clusterfuck. On election day, I was woken up by my alarm in an old but not charming D.C. hotel. I had been in town for nearly a week, making multiple appearances on CNN to explain with great confidence why Hillary Clinton was undoubtedly going to be the next president of the United States. Sleeping soundly the night before an election was incredibly disorienting. For the first time in my professional life, I wasn't about to head to a campaign headquarters to monitor returns from key precincts or hit the road with a candidate stumping for last-minute votes. Other than appearing on CNN to fill dead airtime until the results started coming in, I was going to experience this election just like everyone else. It was game day, and I was on the sidelines. It made me personally uneasy, but I had zero doubt about the results. To be honest, I had never been more confident of anything in my political career. I had spent the last many months assuring everyone that Hillary was going to win, and win easily. It was the hallmark of our podcast. Every week, we were the antidote for the bedwetters, who were panicking about the latest news or the slightest movement in the polls. Keeping it 1600 became Xanax for nervous Democrats. That afternoon, I texted with the senior Clinton campaign aide, who had also been involved with Obama 2012, to ask how the campaign was feeling. "Let me put it this way. I am more confident than we were on Election Day 2012," the aide responded. That was exactly what I wanted to hear. On Election Day 2012, we were incredibly confident about Obama's victory based on our sophisticated data modeling. No need to worry. Later that evening, I went to Cody Keenan's apartment to watch the results come in with Ben Rhodes and Anita Breckenridge. This seemed fitting. Anita Benincodi, who had replaced Favreau as Obama's speechwriter, had been huge parts of my Obama experience going all the way back to 2007. We had been together through good times and bad, traveled hundreds of thousands of miles together, seeing the sights and shutting down bars in far-flung corners of the world. The fact that we were watching on the couch and eating pizza also symbolized how much we thought the whole election was a done deal. I had been to more elaborate Game of Thrones watch parties. The early results were not great, to say the least. I emailed David Plouffe, the person whose political judgment I trusted most. Plouffe was the ultimate anti-bedwetter. When people were really starting to get nervous during the campaign, we would invite Plouffe onto the podcast to soothe the anxious souls of our listeners. We did this as much for our listeners as for ourselves. "You still feeling okay?" I wrote to Plouffe. "Yes, but this could be under 300," he responded almost immediately, referring to the number of electoral votes. That level of optimism was short-lived. The biggest warning sign that we were fucked was that Plouffe had stopped responding to my emails. Rereading my emails from election night as part of my research for this book was a truly terrible experience. With each email, you can see the hopes of all the participants getting progressively more crushed. I would have put them in this book, but you all deserve better. Unfortunately for me, I was scheduled to do a very late night CNN hit. I emailed some friends on the Clinton campaign to say I was going on TV in a few, so if they had some optimistic spin, I would love to have it. The answer I received was that Wisconsin was probably gone, but Michigan was still in play. I didn't want to be the one to tell them that without Wisconsin, they weren't getting to 270. I was texting with Hallie about what I could possibly say on TV about this disaster. She was imploring me to come up with something, but I had nothing. One of the skills you develop in a career in politics is being able to divine some decent message out of any situation, no matter how dire. But I was coming up blank. No words describe what was happening. Right before I was ushered onto the set, a CNN exec stuck her head in to tersely tell me that my services would no longer be needed for the night. They were going to stick with a panel that had been on since 8 p.m. Many people would be annoyed about trekking across town after midnight, putting on gobs of TV makeup, and then sitting in a room with nothing more than tiny bottles of water for over an hour for no reason. Not me. Not on this night. It was a last-minute stay of execution. Not long after, my phone blew up with push notifications informing me of the outcome I never imagined possible. An outcome I'd persuaded everyone would not happen, could not happen, had happened. Donald Trump was president-elect of the United States. Fuck. How did this happen? Explaining the unexplainable. I could not have been more wrong about the 2016 election. Fortunately, I was not alone in being incorrect. It's not just about getting a prediction wrong. That's pretty irrelevant in the grand scheme of things. I'm out of the prediction business anyway. It's about figuring out what has changed in politics that led to Democrats losing the most winnable race in history so that we can figure out how to make sure Trump is a one-term president. A couple of important caveats. First, Hillary would have been a great president. As Barack Obama would often say, she was more qualified than any other person to ever run for the office. Even more importantly, she had the empathy, humility, and intellectual curiosity necessary to do the job well. I would note, Trump has none of these things. I supported her, donated to her, knocked on doors for her. I wish she had won. Second, if the Russians had not intervened, and FBI Director Jim Comey had not decided to violate Department of Justice procedure to announce a short-lived and irrelevant reopening of the email investigation, she would have won the White House, and perhaps by a sizable margin. Finally, there has been a lot of dancing on the graves of the Clinton campaign by people who opposed her in the primary. That is not my intention. I have nothing but respect for the Clinton staff in Brooklyn and across the country who fought so hard to protect us from Trump. If Democrats are going to win future elections and the larger battle against Trumpism, we need to understand how the political firmament shifted and why we missed the shift. With that in mind, here are five things I missed and why I think I missed them. Underestimating Obama's appeal and Hillary's unfair baggage. Hillary the bad candidate has become shorthand to explain the loss. It's worth unpacking this narrative because it's more complicated than that. Yes, Clinton made mistakes. She was overly cautious and played not to lose. She didn't have a clear message or rationale for her candidacy, other than that she would be a good president who would do good things. This is as rational a rationale as you can get, but it's far from electrifying. Her decisions to give speeches to Wall Street banks like Goldman Sachs in exchange for large sums of money was out of touch. And finally, her decision in 2009 to use a private email server was catastrophic because it meant she spent most of the 2016 election under some form of FBI investigation, which was less than ideal, to say the least. But she also had numerous strengths, and I gave these more weight. Yeah, there were going to be challenges, but she was a skilled politician who was willing to put in the work. In the end, I assumed the balance would fall in her favor. In 2008 and 2016, despite narratives to the contrary, there were millions and millions of voters who were passionately excited about her candidacy. And in 2016, she excelled in the most important moments of the campaign, the three nationally televised debates. It's also impossible to talk about assessments of Hillary Clinton's abilities as a candidate without mentioning the insidious effect of sexism in the media and the voting public. Behavior, body language, and tone that were applauded in male candidates were derided in Clinton. At every turn, she was held to a different and unfair standard. She carried the baggage and scars of decades of partisan attacks on her and her husband. Clinton had been portrayed entirely unfairly as the devil incarnate, a combination of Lady Macbeth, Clara Underwood, and Cruella de Vil. We can't forget that right-wing radio spent years convincing people that Hillary Clinton murdered former White House aide Vince Foster. She didn't. And then right-wing Twitter and Fox News spent 4 years convincing people she was responsible for and glibly insensitive to the deaths of Americans in Benghazi. She wasn't. The email server and the paid speeches to Wall Street banks powerfully reinforced the pre-existing negative perceptions of her. But despite all this baggage, I thought Clinton had found an ideal opponent in Donald Trump. If voters didn't trust Clinton, they trusted Trump less. If some voters weren't excited to vote for Clinton, they were more excited to vote against Trump. On top of all this, Obama was very popular and the economy was doing well, both of which historically meant that the incumbent party would retain power. While the Clinton coalition might look a little different from the Obama coalition, it seems certain there would be enough overlap to get her well north of 270. Inside Obama world and the chattering class more generally, it was an article of faith that Obama represented the nadir of Democrats' performance with white voters, and particularly with older white voters who lived in rural areas. As a young, hip African-American with an unusual name and even more unusual background pushing a very progressive agenda, Obama was a poor fit for the more conservative white voters who tend to bounce back and forth between parties. Only 39% of whites voted for Obama in 2012, which was the worst performance for a Democrat in history. It had to get better, right? Nope. Shockingly, Obama got a higher percentage of the white vote and did significantly better in the rural areas that seemed most likely to improve for Hillary Clinton. According to post-election studies, only about three-quarters of the white Obama voters with a high school diploma voted for Clinton. Her support among these voters was even lower in the Rust Belt battleground states. I have been accused many times, always fairly, of being an unrepentant Obama Kool-Aid drinker. But even I underestimated Barack Obama's appeal to independents and conservative Democrats. Instead of causing older, more conservative white voters to flee the Democratic Party, Obama was holding on to these voters who might otherwise have left years ago. There was something unique about his appeal that transcended race and ideology. It was this appeal that fueled his insurgent 2008 campaign. It was why I went to work for him in 2008, and by 2016, politics had become so partisan that I took for granted that his appeal was unique. Winning back those voters won't be easy and won't be enough to win, but has to happen if we want to succeed. 2. The death of electability. The traditional definition of electability is dead. We think about political campaigns through the prism of electability. What specific traits or positions do voters consider preferable, and what things are deal breakers? But like most political analysis, on questions of electability, we tend to look backwards as opposed to projecting forward. For a long time, this made sense. Or at least we thought it did. The first 43 presidents were all very similar. They all had similar backgrounds, senators, vice presidents, or governors. Many had served in the military. They were all white male politicians who looked not that different from all the people who grace our money. After John Kerry lost the 2004 election, the conventional wisdom among Democrats was that the only way for Democrats to return to the White House in 2008 was to nominate someone from a red state with experience winning over independents and Republicans. 3 years later, Barack Hussein Obama, from the south side of Chicago via Hawaii and Indonesia, won the White House. 8 years after that, Donald J. Trump, a dotty old racist reality TV star, won the White House. I need to hat tip John Lovett here. A man who had never served in public office, never served in the military, never served his country or his community in any way big or small, a man famous for being famous. Although as a white male, Trump looked like all the guys on our money, nothing else about him fit the definition of electable, and it was that fact that polluted all the coverage of him. Because I, and almost everyone else, thought Trump was too loud, too crass, too inexperienced, and ultimately, too ridiculous to be elected, I discounted his strengths as a candidate and the power of the political forces that propelled his candidacy. In some ways, Trump is an accidental president, winning on a technicality with help from the Russian judge, but he did beat the best and brightest the Republican Party had to offer in 2016, and in doing so, reshaped one of our two major political parties. I wouldn't be me if I didn't point out that beating the best the Republican Party had to offer in 2016 is a little like being the tallest of the seven dwarfs. Until recently, electability was a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Campaigns are fueled by money and media attention, and the only candidates who had access to either were the ones donors and members of the media determined were electable. This thinking ultimately affected voter preference. Voters in primaries are the most engaged of all voters, and they pick only candidates they think can win. As it has done to so much else in politics, the internet also upended who can be elected president. Candidates now have the ability to bypass the political tastemakers and go directly to the voters to make their case. Candidates can bypass the big political check writers and raise money on the internet from grassroots donors. If the media won't take their candidacy seriously enough, candidates can communicate directly with the public through Twitter and Facebook. Applying an outdated filter of electability was a fundamental error, and a particularly foolish one for someone who'd had a front-row seat to Barack Obama's rise. Using that same filter in 2008, I wouldn't have bothered moving to Chicago. In the future, when some pundit, or podcaster, tells you not to bother supporting some candidate because they can't win, or that the election is in the bag because the other party nominated some, quote, unelectable candidate, do not listen. 3. Best messenger wins. After the 2016 election, whenever I would appear on some post-election panel, I'd give the audience an exercise. First, I would ask them, what was Donald Trump's positive argument for himself? The audience would unanimously shout back, make America great again. Then I would ask them if they knew what Trump's argument against Hillary Clinton was. The audience would respond by saying, crooked Hillary and lock her up. Next, I would do the same exercise for Hillary. What was her argument against Trump? The audience would respond with a cacophony of responses, unfit, racist, sexist, liar, thief, bully, and on and on. When I'd ask the audience about Hillary's argument for herself, it would be near silence. A few would murmur experience or qualified, but without much conviction or enthusiasm. For all of Trump's offensive statements and absurd tweets, he had a clear and consistent message that broke through. And the candidate with the more clear and consistent message always wins. Most of Trump's positive message was without a doubt nonsensical bullshit, but it was memorable enough to be emblazoned on hats and abbreviated into a hashtag. Trump's argument against Hillary was also unfair and inaccurate, but he was swimming with the current. It fit with an existing narrative about her that was believable to a large portion of the populace. The most effective political tacks are ones that fit into what people are already willing to believe. The 2016 political environment was unique. The incumbent Democratic president was historically popular, and incredibly popular with the Democratic voters Clinton needed to turn out. But they were also hungry enough for change that they backed Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in large numbers in the Democratic primaries. Clinton struggled to find the right balance between appealing to the voters who loved Obama and showing the broader electorate how a Clinton presidency would be different and better than Obama's. Trump certainly offered the Clinton campaign no shortage of opportunities to attack him. In fact, that may have been part of the problem. Every campaign starts the day with a call, meeting, an email chain, or a Slack channel to discuss what the opponent did or said that they could go after that day. In most campaigns, you are lucky if you have one good hit a day and are often scraping the bottom of the barrel to find a negative message to drive that day. I always imagine the Clinton campaign just had a rolling 24-hour meeting because every 3 minutes Trump would say something outrageous or dishonest, or a story would emerge about some past outrageous behavior that would have disqualified every other previous candidate from continuing their campaign. The ethos of the modern campaign is never let a pitch go by. Hit your opponent and hit them hard. Don't stop until the election is over. Trump's flaws, gaffes, and moral outrages were so numerous that the Clinton campaign found it almost impossible to drive a consistent narrative against Trump. One day he was an intolerant, deplorable racist. The next day he was temperamentally unfit for office. The day after he was a misogynist who bragged about sexually assaulting women and a rapacious businessman who profited off the very same working class voters he claimed to champion. These critiques were true, and some of them Clinton was morally obligated to make, even if they weren't the, quote, message of the day. It would be wrong not to call out bigotry and misogyny. But in the end, these various arguments were never woven into a single coherent narrative about why Donald Trump shouldn't be president. During the campaign, I supported and encouraged the Clinton campaign strategy, but in hindsight, I lost track of all the core lessons of Obama's success. Campaigns are about telling the American people a story about where we are, where we are going, and why you are the right person and your opponent is the wrong person to take the country there. It's a story that needs to be compelling, but also easily understood, and then driven home by the candidate and the campaign with relentless discipline. In 2008, Obama's message against Clinton and McCain was so simple. Change versus the status quo. Clinton represented the same old politics that had led to missed opportunities and lost elections, and McCain represented a continuation of George W. Bush's failed policies at home and abroad. In 2012, as the incumbent president, Obama can no longer run as the change agent against the status quo. Every time he stood behind a podium with a presidential seal or boarded Air Force One, it reminded the world that Obama was now the establishment, not the insurgent. Democrats are rightly and reflexively repulsed by the idea of learning anything from Trump or drawing parallels between Trump and Obama. Just reading that sentence made me throw up in my mouth a little. Yet we cannot discount Trump's success at having a message that worked in 2016 or ignore the failure of the Democrats to turn their very worthwhile policy agenda and their even more legitimate arguments against Trump into a message that fit in a tweet or on an ugly red hat. Simple is better, but simple doesn't mean simplistic. 4. Too much science, not enough storytelling. Up until Election Day 2016, I had a real pet peeve about modern political journalism. In the modern era, political campaigns are high-tech affairs that use highly sophisticated data analytics to understand the political environment and craft messages and strategies. Campaigns are now more science than art, yet they are covered by English majors, who treat campaigns like Shakespearean dramas with dramatic plot twists. There are exceptions to this rule, most notably Nate Silver of 538, who pioneered the idea of data journalism. The gap between the science of campaigns and the art of journalism was never clearer than the final weeks of the 2012 campaign. The press believed that Romney was surging toward the finish line, citing anecdotal evidence such as rally crowd sizes, the frequency of yard signs, and the slightest movement in inherently flawed media polls. In phone calls, coffees, and late-night discussions in hotel bars on the campaign trail, we would try to convince the media that they were focusing on the noise, but we could see the signal. The data we saw was very clear that Obama was headed for a sizable electoral victory. The media presumed this was just spin. They were wrong. The election perfectly mirrored what we told reporters was going to happen, down to a shocking level of specificity of things like the early voting margins in states such as Ohio, Florida, and Colorado. This was the first time the media realized how far campaigns, or at least Obama's campaign, had advanced, and how the amount of data at the campaign's fingertips so far outpaced anything the media could ever know. The media was covering the tip of the iceberg, with no capacity to see what was happening below the surface. Data became the new big thing in politics. Reporters wrote about it, and campaigns became obsessed with it. Math majors had never been more in demand. If the lesson of the Obama campaign was that data could be decisive, the lesson of the Clinton campaign was that it wasn't perfect. In 2012, analytics was new enough that the Obama campaign still wanted a three-part system in place to constantly check on what the data was telling us. We were not yet ready to put all of our eggs into the data basket. Part one was the data itself, which was refreshed nightly through tens of thousands of robocalls asking voters who their preference was between Romney and Obama in every battleground state. Part two was the traditional polls the campaigns have used for nearly a century, live people asking approximately 1,000 people per state about the race. Part three was the massive army of volunteers and field organizers who were talking to voters on the phones and at the doors every night. If one of those three data points was out of line, it was cause for concern that something was afoot, and we would dig in deeper with additional research to see if it was an anomaly or a real problem. As more of our lives move online, the ability of campaigns to predict who you will vote for and what issues you care about will only grow. One misfire isn't going to mean the campaigns will go back to using an abacus. But there is a second lesson about the dangers of relying so heavily on data in campaigns. The vast amounts of available data and sophisticated models can divide with great precision which message voters most want to hear, and social media and other technologies give campaigns the ability to target individual voters with those individually designed messages. Millennials in urban areas want a president who believes in climate change. Female voters over the age of 50, but under the age of 65, who are unmarried, have a college degree, and live in rural areas, care most about education. White male NASCAR fans care about healthcare and are worried about terrorism. These new tools provide campaigns with the dangerous temptation of telling each voter what they want to hear instead of developing an overall message that appeals to everyone. Political campaigns are ultimately about inspiring people to get off their couch and go wait in line, often for hours, to cast their vote. This is a big ask. It's much different than selling soap or affordable razors. It can't be paint by numbers. The folly of this strategy was perhaps best explained by Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State who lost a tough race for Senate in 2016, but impressed everyone by outperforming Hillary Clinton by 16 points. On a post-election episode of the podcast, when Jon Favreau and I asked about what went wrong with Democrats in 2016, Kander described two different approaches. Imagine, he said, a lawyer making a closing argument to the jury, and that lawyer makes a different argument to each juror, trying to individually convince them with slightly different rationales, with the whole jury watching. Now, imagine an attorney who makes one argument that attempts to persuade the entire jury. Which do you think will work better? That's never going to change, nor should it. But no matter how precise the data or advanced the technology, campaigns will always be decided by who tells a more compelling story about America. As Democrats, we may have lost sight of that important fact. 5. The economy's stupid. On the 1992 Clinton campaign, strategist James Carville hung a sign on the wall of the Little Rock, Arkansas headquarters that outlined the three crucial messages for the campaign. Change versus more of the same. The economy's stupid. Don't forget about healthcare. This strategy propelled Bill Clinton to a surprising win in 1992, and these principles became the bedrock of Democratic campaigns. Axelrod, who was Obama's Carville, didn't write these exact principles on the wall, but they were at the heart of the Obama 2008 strategy. With the possible exception of the period right after 9/11, the economy has been the most important issue on the mind of voters. It's the prism through which voters judge candidates. In 2012 against Romney, the overwhelming majority of ads the campaign ran, every speech Obama gave, and every tweet the campaign sent out was about the economy. Obama's plan versus Romney's plan. The core argument of the campaign was that Obama fought for people like you, and Romney fought for people like him. And the proof was in their very different economic policies. To Axelrod's great credit, in the decade we worked together, he never went a day, or even an hour, without reminding us never to lose sight of the economic message. There is an irony that Hillary Clinton's campaign might have been the first Democratic campaign to diverge from those principles. Since Hillary Clinton had been on the national stage for so long and was running to replace a popular two-term president, change versus more the same was a hard message for her campaign. It would be literally impossible to forget about healthcare since the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010. Opposing that law has been the animating principle of the Republican Party ever since, while protecting it has been a litmus test for the Democrats. In hindsight, the Democrats generally, and the Clinton campaign specifically, forgot the most important part of the Carville Doctrine, the economy's stupid. This is not to say that Hillary Clinton didn't have gobs of great economic policy positions. She did. And this is not to say that she didn't talk about those positions on the stump as she campaigned across the country. She most certainly did. But the economic message most certainly didn't break through. There is no doubt the media is partly to blame because they simply wouldn't cover her policy positions or her policy-based critiques of Trump. To get coverage, she had to make personality-based attacks. Trump is a liar. That goes viral. Trump is a racist. That leads the news. Trump bragged about sexual assault. That gets 100,000 retweets. Trump wants to give tax credits to wealthy people like him and balloon the deficit. Crickets. In the wake of Clinton's loss, the Democratic Party is engaged in a self-defeating debate about whether the party should embrace a strategy based on identity politics that targets the Obama coalition of millennials, women, and people of color, or a strategy that uses an economic populist message to court working-class voters. This is a stupid debate because it is both a false choice and not a choice at all. It is simply not an option for Democrats to remain silent on issues of racism and misogyny, particularly when those repugnant views are emanating from the Oval Office. We have a moral and political obligation to be a bulwark against Trump's hateful rhetoric. Democrats must also recognize that despite the low unemployment and high Dow Jones average at the end of the Obama years, the economy remains the single most important issue in American politics. It is the connective tissue between all parts of society. Economic anxiety is real, and for good reason. The gap between the rich and poor is growing larger. Advances in technology are changing what a job means in this country. Automation and globalization are taking away the blue-collar manufacturing jobs that used to be the bedrock of middle-class life. We need policies and a message that explain why Democrats are the right party and Republicans are the wrong to shepherd the country through an uncertain economic future. If we lose that battle, Democrats will not see the halls of power for a very long time. Are we permanently screwed? Politics is a fickle beast. In the summer of 2006, a book came out called One Party Country about how George W. Bush and Karl Rove were on the cusp of building a permanent Republican majority that would rule politics till the end of time. A few months later, the Democrats took back the House and the Senate in a landslide victory. 2 years after that, Barack Obama won a huge electoral landslide, capturing states that no Democrat had won in decades. The country that I saw traveling with Barack Obama bears no resemblance to the one that Trump describes. The American people are good and decent and want the best for one another in the country. Are there exceptions? Of course. President Trump is one of them. The path back for Democrats is pretty clear and doesn't mean becoming more like Trump.